Thanks for the introduction. Thanks for the invitation. I'm used to people just sort of introducing and saying, this is David Snoke from Pittsburgh. So that was a nice introduction there. Let's see, where's the laser pointer? So yeah, I think this is one of these stories that is a long-term story. Can we see coherent solids is one word for it. I'm going to try to present a bunch of evidence that we think we have. I want to start by acknowledging the people that have to be acknowledged. First of all, the graduate students, Ryan Belili and Vincent Hartwell, have done all the data that you see here, done a terrific job. And also, one of the important parts of this story is the quality of the samples. In the last 10 or 15 years, the quality of semiconductor structures has really improved to the point that we can really be talking about long-range motion of carriers, the disorder is low enough that you can really think about these things as gases of carriers in a two-dimensional system. Whereas before that, in most of these structures, the carriers were localized in disorder, and disorder is dominating all the behavior. And so we're really able to study two-dimensional physics here. Let me just give you an outline then. First of all, I'm going to talk about what is an exciton polariton. That's a big, complicated name, so I need to spend some time discussing that. Second, I want to try to convince you to think of these things as real particles. A lot of times when I talk about quasi-particles, that name quasi-particle sounds like, well, it's not really a particle, it's just sort of a particle. You know, it's quasi-particle. That's not what we mean. I'm going to try to convince you that these are real things that move around inside a crystal. They move from here to there, and they interact with each other like a gas, and that's the proper way to talk about them. And in fact, we can trap them and hold them in traps just like the atom traps used for cold atoms. Then I'll give you a set of evidence that we have for the quasi-equilibrium Bose condensation, including some of the differences from a standard condensate. And last, if I have time, I'll talk about some quibbles that experts have raised I may skip some of that depending on how time goes. All right, so let's start at the beginning. What is an exciton? This is still not taught in textbooks everywhere. A lot of people go through their graduate career without ever hearing what an exciton is. The simplest way to think about it is the word excite is the root there, so it's a quantum of excitation in a solid. And so the way to think about it, if I think of this picture here, suppose I have a set of two-level systems, which could be a bunch of atoms in a crystal, and I excite an electron from a ground state up to an excited state. And so now I've put in energy into the system, and I've done this. Now, if you think about this, I've really put two particles in the system, not one. I absorbed a photon, but I now have a free electron up here in the upper set of states, and I also have an empty state down here, which is what we call a hole. It's a lack of an electron in the lower state. So now, the electron up here sees a bunch of nearby empty states, so it's free to move around. The electrons down here, before it was excited, had no degrees of freedom to move because of polyexclusion. But now this electron up here is free to move in these states. Well, what happens if it does? Suppose that it moves over here. Well, in that case now, you notice you've got an excess of negative charge in this part of the crystal because we've got two electrons on one atom. And so in general, electrons are going to be repelled from this region. Well, if they're repelled, where can they go? Well, the only place they can go is into this hole, which is this empty state. And so one of them will likely be kicked over there. And so that's one way of thinking about it, but a completely equivalent way of thinking about it is to say that the hole is attracted to this electron. The hole is acting like a particle with positive charge. And so it is feeling a Coulomb attraction because it has positive charge. It's feeling a Coulomb attraction to the negative electron. And so in general, these two particles, the electron, the excited electron and the hole, move as a unit. The hole is going to follow the electron, and so they move together through the crystal. But it's energetically equivalent where they are in the solid. So the pair can be anywhere in the solid. So in general, that pair can move with no energy cost all the way through the solid. Now, that's sort of the model I've given here is the electron, the hole sitting on single atoms. But in semiconductors, in general, the attraction of the electron on the hole is not so tight that the hole has to stay exactly next to the electron. And in general, they can be quite far apart, sometimes hundreds of lattice sites apart. And so this is what we call the Vanier limit, where the electron on the hole can now be seen as orbiting each other inside the solid. And so we have here this picture really exactly like a hydrogen atom. The electron on the hole, or really the better analogy is positronium, where you have a particle and an antiparticle orbiting each other and bound to each other by Coulomb interaction. And the only difference, you really can solve the exact same equations as positronium for the Rydberg states. The only difference is that everything is scaled by the dielectric constant of the medium, which is about 10 in typical semiconductors. And so instead of electron volts for the binding energy, you divide by 10 squared, that gets you down to millielectron volts of binding energy. So the typical binding energy of these excitons are tens of millielectron volts. And by the same argument, the Bohr radius of this little atom is larger by the dielectric constant. So these are typically 50 or 100 angstroms in size rather than just a few angstroms. All right, well, the next step then is what is a polariton? I've talked about what an exciton is. All right, well, to visualize this, imagine that we're going to take the excitons and we're going to keep them restricted to a two-dimensional plane, which is called a quantum well. And then that is going to be embedded between two mirrors. Now, the way we make these mirrors, this is a solid-state system. And so the mirrors are actually Bragg mirrors. They're sets of alternating dielectric layers that are embedded in the solid. And in between, we have spacers, which is also solid. But the spacers aren't really relevant, so you can just think of that as vacuum. And so we've got a two-dimensional plane containing excitons embedded between two mirrors. And we're going to put the quantum well at one of the antinodes of the confined photon mode. Now, what does that do for us? Well, first of all, let's think about the photon mode, just the bouncing photon mode between the two mirrors. Well, its energy is just given by h-bar ck, where k is the magnitude of the wave number. But the kz component, which is the k in this direction, is quantized because only certain modes can fit between these two mirrors. And so we stick in a fixed number for that for a particular mode. On the other hand, the photon still has freedom in the perpendicular direction. It can bounce along between these mirrors. And so we have now, this is a formula for a cavity photon. Notice that even at k parallel equal to zero, we have a finite energy or frequency for the photon. So that would correspond to one bouncing exactly back and forth with no sideways motion. And its energy depends on the length of the cavity. That's going to be important. Now, on the other hand, the excitons in the quantum well have this energy. And just running through these quickly, this is the gap energy of the semiconductor. That's the energy difference between the excited state and the ground state. We gain some energy because of the binding energy, the Coulombic binding energy, which is also a constant. Then we have, this is what's called the confinement energy. This is exactly what you get from freshman physics for a particle in a box. So you simply have the fact that there's a thickness of this layer, and there's going to be a restriction on the wavelength of the exciton depending on what that layer thickness is. And so if you do freshman square well potential physics, you just get this. This is just the confinement energy in the box. And then last, we have a kinetic energy of the excitons in the plane. They can move freely in this two-dimensional plane. Okay, so we've got two things going on now. We've got excitons in this plane, and we've got photons bouncing back and forth between the mirrors. So what are we going to do with this? We're going to bring those into resonance. Because they both depend on length that we can tune, we can bring them into resonance. We can make those have the same energy. So here is now E versus K parallel. This is the momentum in the plane. And so this is the equation I just gave you for the photon mode in the cavity. And remember, it has a minimum at some energy, or at k equals zero. And then in addition, we have the exciton energy, which on this scale is essentially constant. And we're going to bring these into resonance at that point. Now, the exciton is polarizable. It has a plus charge and minus charge. And you can think of them as attached by a spring. So if I put an electric field on, I stretch the exciton. So I gain some dipole moment. And so that means there's a coupling between the exciton and the photons. If a photon comes in, the electric field will cause some oscillation of the exciton, and so that leads to feedback or coupling between these. Well, in quantum mechanics, whenever we have degenerate levels with some coupling between them, we get anti-crossing, we get splitting of states. And so if I simply solve the quantum mechanics for this coupled system of two oscillators in resonance, I get two new states coming out of that, what's called the upper polariton branch and the lower polariton branch. And so they've been pushed away from each other by some energy here, which is basically the coupling energy, also called the Rabi splitting. Now, for the rest of the talk, I'm going to focus on this lower polariton branch. This is the end of the day thing that we're looking at here. This is now a new eigenstate in the system. It's a quasi-particle with this particular dispersion relation. And in particular, it has an effective mass. What I mean by an effective mass is that I could fit this bottom part to a parabola. Any minimum can always be fit to a parabola. And that parabola would have the same shape as p squared over 2m, the energy of a particle with mass. Okay? So there's an effective mass of this minimum here. And that effective mass turns out to be very small. It turns out to be 10 to the minus 4 electron masses. So that's a really light particle, but not zero. And so it has this parabolic dispersion to it. Okay, why is light effective mass interesting? Well, the condition for quantum coherent effects is generally this, that when the particle spacing, when I have one particle here and another particle here, they have an associated de Broglie wavelength, a quantum mechanical wavelength. And when that wavelength is comparable to the distance between them, then exchange of the particles becomes important. You can't tell the difference of which one is which because their wave functions are overlapping. And so that's the general condition for all these Bose condensation, superconductor, and so on conditions, when quantum mechanics becomes important. Well, the RS spacing, the average spacing between the atoms, it just depends on their density. But the de Broglie wavelength depends on their mass and their temperature. Okay, that's the same as this condition then. And so if we just turn that around and solve for T, we get in general that T is that the condition for quantum effects is when the temperature is comparable to, again, this number, which is basically the interparticle spacing, but there's a mass in there, and the mass is in the denominator. So that means the lighter the mass, the higher the temperature that we can see these effects. And so if we think about polaritons with a mass of 10 to the minus 4 electron masses compared to an atom which has a mass of sometimes 100 proton masses, each of which is 1,800 times an electron mass, you can see that the TC is going to be enormously higher, even at much lower densities for these polaritons. And so that's one of the appeals, that we could see a room temperature condensate as well as one in a solid. Okay, now one thing you might have thought of is when I showed you this photon state, you might say, well, that's also got an effective mass, right? That's also a parabolic minimum. So why not just use the photon? Why dress it with this exciton? Because after all, the photon has some effective mass as well. The reason is that photons are non-interacting, or at least extremely weakly interacting. And so if we had only the bare cavity photons, they would simply pass through each other. There would be no interactions between them. And the interactions become extremely important for thermalization of the gas. We want these particles to scatter with each other so that they can thermalize through collisions. Now, what we end up with then is particles which have a strong short-range interaction. And these are going to be important numbers. The lifetime of the polariton, before it leaves the cavity, it turns into a photon to leave the system, is tens of picoseconds. The scattering time is a function of density. It's typically shorter, but not a whole lot shorter than the lifetime. That's going to lead to interesting sort of quasi-equilibrium effects, the fact that it's never going to be able to live long enough to establish a true equilibrium. And so that leads to some of the interesting physics. But in general, the short time scales don't really matter as far as the thermal behavior, because, you know, if you're in physics, you know that we don't think in terms of absolute time, we think in terms of relative time scales. And so if you think about the condition for equilibrium, it's when you can say that the lifetime of the system is long compared to the scattering time. And so, for instance, in astronomy, you can have an equilibrium distribution of stars where the time scale, the proper time scale, is millions of years for their scattering with each other. On the other hand, you can have systems like this where they only live for picoseconds, but if they can scatter and thermalize with each other on even shorter time scales than that, then it doesn't really matter what their absolute lifetime is. It's just a matter of rescaling everything to lower energies and shorter time scales. Okay, now this is for the experts here. I just want to briefly mention this. The interactions are extremely important for the stability of the condensate. This is an old argument of Nozier. I don't know if it was original with him, but it's in the Green Book that I did with Alan Griffin many years ago in a nice article by Nozier. It turns out you could ask why, you know, you might think from your introductory thermodynamics, well, you just know you do the ideal gas and you get a Bose condensate. Turns out that the ideal Bose gas is pathological. It would not be stable to being broken up into multiple condensates. And you can show this by simply calculating the total energy due to interactions. If I have all the particles in one condensate, I'm going to have roughly this amount of energy, which goes as n squared. In other words, the energy per particle is on the order of the density of n. On the other hand, if I broke it into two condensates, I end up, and I'm not going to go through all the math here, I end up having an extra term, which is due to exchange, which is macroscopic. I have a macroscopic term, so if I want to break the condensate into two parts, even if I don't pay any energy for moving to another state, there's an exchange energy just to break up the condensate, and that's macroscopic. And so one way of thinking about Bose condensation is to say that it's a phase transition driven by exchange energy, that the energy which is being minimized when you condense in the condensate phase transition is the exchange energy between the bosons. Now, if there were no interactions between the particles, there would be no exchange term, okay? And so the thing would not be stable. So it's very important that we dress these photons with the interactions because the photons are non-interacting. Okay, now my next step, how are we going to trap these things? We want to hold them in a bucket. Well, they're neutral, they're charge neutral, so we're not going to be able to use electric fields very effectively. But in solids, there's a couple effects that we can use that are related to stress. One is simply to imagine that we take the unit cell of the solid and we squeeze it and we make it smaller. Well, essentially, the wavelength that can fit in the box is then going to become shorter. And if that wavelength is shorter, that corresponds to higher energy. So in general, squeezing solids costs energy. I'm squeezing them and making the wavelengths of the particles shorter. Conversely, if I expand the solid, then that drops the energy. So if I have some place where I can stretch the crystal and make it larger, then that's going to lead to an energy minimum. The other thing that happens with stress is what's called a shear stress. A shear stress is one in which I'm not squeezing it to make it smaller, but I'm, say, twisting it or I'm doing something to change the symmetry of the crystal. If I change the symmetry, then if I have any degenerate states, they oftentimes will split. And so I'll, in general, have one state going up and one state going down. So for any shear stress, I always have one state which is going to lower energy. So what we actually do in our experiments then, and this is one that bothers people who actually work with semiconductor wafers because it looks like we're just going to break the sample. We take the sample and we hold it between two plates. The bottom side is unconstrained. And now we poke it with a pin, literally a pin on the back side. Now, of course, this is highly exaggerated. This thing is not so elastic that we get actual bend of the wafer. This is the type of strain that we generate. The quantum wells are on the bottom surface here. So all of the action is down here. This is mostly just gallium arsenide substrate, and we have quantum wells on the bottom side. This is a solution, just a numerical solution of the stresses. This is a hydrostatic strain here, and this is the shear strain. And you notice the hydrostatic term has a positive sign, which means that it's an expansion. We're literally stretching the sample on the bottom. On the top, it's being compressed, but down here, it's being expanded. It has to stretch. And so then if we just do the experiment, okay, this is a fairly old story now. This is, again, our geometry just poking here, exciting with the laser from the bottom side and then looking at the light emission coming back out. Using known deformation potentials for gallium arsenide, we get a good fit of the shift of the band. So this is now what you're looking at. This is the exciton energy as a function of position. Now, this is not in a microcavity. This is just excitons in a quantum well. This is fairly old data. But what we see is, indeed, we get a nice fit to our deformation potential theory, and we have a energy minimum for the excitons. And here it's about a couple hundred microns across. All right, now let me talk about some details of the microcavities. In general, all these MBE-grown samples, we have these various layers. The layer thickness does not stay constant across the whole wafer. They're literally spraying these things on like a spray paint can. And so all these layers are built up by MBE growth. And so there's a layer thickness variation across the wafer. And we can actually use that to our advantage because that allows us to tune the relative energy of the photon and the exciton. Remember, the condition for these things to come into being is when they're resonant with each other. Well, in some places, it's going to be that the photon state is the lowest energy state. And then as the thickness varies as you go out from the center of the wafer, the photon part is going to be strongly dependent on the thickness, the exciton part weakly dependent on the thickness, and so they're going to cross at some point. And this region here of anti-crossing, that's exactly the point where these polaritons are in resonance. Now let me just blow that up. This is now data reflectivity data. So this is now the upper polariton and the lower polariton as a function of position on the sample. And so you see that there's a minimum position here where that's the resonant point, and that's a fairly large splitting. That's about 15 millielectron volts compared to inhomogeneous broadening of less than a millielectron volt. So this is what we call strong coupling. At that point, when we're in that region where they're coupled to each other, then you truly have a superposition of the exciton, which is a excitation of the matter in the solid, and the photon. And you can't really distinguish. The polariton is now the proper eigenstate, and you really can't talk about it as being a photon or an exciton. It's this new beast, which is a superposition of both. All right, now, in our experiments, we're going to do one additional thing. We're going to come in with our pin, and we're going to poke the sample not in this region of resonance. We're going to poke it somewhere over here, which corresponds to, you know, someplace on the wafer here, where the photon state is initially the lowest state. And remember, these are the exciton states. And the exciton states react to stress, as I just showed you. The photon states don't. The photon states are just optics. And so the dielectric constant of the medium doesn't depend on the stress very much. So what we're going to do is we're going to shift these states. We're simply going to push the exciton states down into the photon states to achieve resonance. So we use this method as a way of tuning the bands in our crystal over tens of millielectron volts. And it's actually a generic technique. It's not something specific to these things. You can use stresses to shift the bands in solids all the time for lots of different purposes. Okay, now this is looking at that side a little bit closer. Okay, so we're going to look at this point here where we have essentially a very fast dependence of the photon energy on the position. Okay, so that's the same reflectivity spectrum. This is photoluminescence in the same place. And now we're going to start poking this. So we're sort of zooming in, looking closer and closer at points on this spectrum. This is now as we increase the stress. This is, again, just the same data. And now we're poking with a pin here, and we're seeing that both the upper polariton and the lower polariton are shifted, and both of them have a dimple. They have an energy minimum at the point right under the pin. And so this is going to be our trap, this little parabolic minimum in the overall polariton. And so here it's mostly photon-like, here it's mostly photon-like, but here we brought it into resonance so that the exciton and the photon are resonant in that trap. Okay, let's zoom in a little more. Okay, so now we're zooming in on the trap. This is, again, unstressed, and now with stress. We've actually pushed, in this case, the exciton through the photon state, and so we have now a sort of a ring of resonance. The laser is going to primarily generate polaritons in a ring. You can see these points here are the resonance. So that's what these bright spots are here. So we have a defocused laser sort of illuminating this whole region. And so we're creating the polaritons here, and then they're going to flow down into the bottom of the trap. So they accumulate in the bottom of the trap. And so this is one of my first take-home stories. These things really do move. Okay? Here's a pictures where now we're doing a slightly different experiment. We have the same trap, okay, but now we're focusing the laser. Instead of defocusing over the whole region, we're focusing the laser to a spot right there, and now I'm going to move the laser spot around, okay, and you see as they get closer, they start to fill in the bottom of the trap. Here I'm in the trap, okay, and now I'm moving off the other side, and you notice there's this overall gradient, so this is higher on this side. And again, what I'm doing, this, the laser's creating them here, and they're flowing downhill into the bottom of the trap. That's a distance of about 50 microns. So let's see. That's way far away. And again, this is flowing the opposite way. On the other side, they drift in the opposite direction. You may not think, how do we get a force here? Okay, well, any gradient of energy is a force. Okay, so we have a gradient of energy going downhill to the bottom of this trap. And so the polaritons are pulled or sucked down into the bottom of the trap by that force. And so what we're going to do now is we're going to generate them on the side here and look at what happens in the bottom of the well. Okay, now I have to maybe recalibrate for some of you the way of thinking about these experiments. I told you that the condition was, in general, that the interparticle spacing should be comparable to the de Broglie wavelength. That in general means that the superfluid or whatever coherent effect is going to be a low temperature and high density effect. Well, if you're used to thinking about liquid helium or atomic gases, you tend to think of sitting at fixed density and dropping temperature. And so you define a TC as you sit at some density, you come down, and you hit the superfluid phase at some critical temperature and keep going down. Well, in these experiments, temperature is not a control parameter. Essentially, there's a balance of energy. You're pumping in these things. They're going to fall from high energy by emitting phonons into the lattice, that is heat, and then they're going to die at some point before they reach the very bottom. And so, in general, the average temperature of the medium is a function of how hard we're pumping and other things. And so temperature is not what we have a knob to control. On the other hand, we do have a knob to control, which is the density. We can simply turn up the laser, which creates these things. So we're pumping in light, and we're just going to watch the density increase. So in all of these experiments, I'm going to talk about a critical density. So we're sitting at fixed temperature and increasing the density and seeing what happens as we come up. So I'll be talking about a critical density threshold, which is really, it's the same transition in either direction. Now, another characteristic here is that the trap implies a spatial condensation. If you do textbook ideal Bose-Gas condensation, it will tell you that the ground state is the K equals zero state, which is a translation of the invariant state. But as soon as you put a trap on, the ground state is now a localized Gaussian-type state. And so we expect if I start with the thing in a non-condensate state and I have this cloud of particles, and the size of the cloud is going to be determined by the temperatures. It's going to be as they sort of flow scattering around to all different energies in this trap. When I get a condensate, the condensate will appear in whatever the ground state is. And so that will be some localized state in the bottom of the trap. And so in the trap, a condensate corresponds to both a momentum space narrowing and a real space narrowing. Okay, we get a momentum space narrowing. Just basically, it becomes the momentum space is just the Fourier transform of that real space wave function. Okay, so here's the experiment. We have a we're pumping high up in energy. So we're pumping 100 or so millielectron volts above the ground state of these excitons. And one reason why we're doing that is so that all coherence of the laser that generates them is lost. So it's really just because when we pump them up there, they're going to emit phonons. They're going to have to scatter all over the place before they ever turn into polaritons. So we want that on purpose because we don't want the coherence of the laser to just sort of be directly printed into these polaritons. We want to see whether coherence will appear spontaneously. And so we're pumping high up. We're using a CW laser, so very low intensities, not an intense pulse laser, which will give us all kinds of nonlinear effects. And we're also circularly polarizing the pumping, which will be important later. Okay, so what do we see? This is the emission, the photon emission from the polaritons. The photons coming out essentially is telling us how many polaritons we have because they all die by emitting photons. And so in all these experiments, we're looking at photon emission as our signature for where the polaritons are and what they're doing. And we indeed see as we turn up the density that we have a threshold behavior. At some point, as we turn up our average power, we see this exponential cut-on, and then eventually that's going to saturate and flatten out again. So the question is, at this point here, where this threshold is turning up, what happens to the polaritons at that point? Okay, well, this is what happens spatially. This is now looking at, we're generating the polaritons in the trap. So we have, at low density, we have a big cloud of polaritons which are sitting in the trap, essentially just localized in that, whatever the temperature is going to indicate for that. As we turn up the density, you might think that turning up the density would make the cloud hotter, which would maybe give you a pressure which would push it outward. And in fact, that is seen if you don't have a trap. On the other hand, here, if there's a condensate, the ground state of the trap is going to be, as I told you, this narrow localized spot. And so as we turn up the density, we see first a two-component thing. We've got a broad thing and a narrow thing sitting on top of it. And then as we keep going up, again, boom, we have this sharp peak where essentially all of the emission, all of the polaritons are now sitting in the center of the trap in this very sharp peak. I see that the slides are somewhat cut off here also because the scaling isn't quite right. I think I'll probably skip this point here. This is sort of for the experts. So let me just go on to another thing we can do. What if we just create them on the side? Okay, here now, this is a similar sequence where we create the polaritons not in the center, but we create them over on the side, At low power, they fall down the hill and they fill up this whole trap. So we have this big wide cloud, which is the thermal cloud. And now as we turn up the laser power, we have, here's again the place of generation where we're creating them, but we see narrowing up, and then finally you see at the highest powers we see just the place where we created them and this peak appearing of the condensate. So this is important, at least psychologically for me, because in a lot of these experiments, you might say, okay, well, I've got a laser here, and I'm seeing some sharp peak appear. How do I know it's not just some nonlinear effect of the laser itself? Okay, well, in these experiments, the laser isn't even around. Okay, the condensate's over here, and the laser's over here about 20, 30 microns away. Okay, so this is not just an amplification of the laser. It's not just some nonlinear optical effect, because it's spatially separated from where the laser even is. The laser is quite distant. And so the action is now appearing at this condensate down here in the center. Now, one of the things that you want to look for in any kind of condensate is evidence of coherence. This is probably a lot of people are familiar with these beautiful experiments of interference fringes of condensates, which are now sort of passé. So can we see this with the polaritons? Well, this is the experiment we're going to do. We're not the first to do this. We're going to take the polaritons, which are sitting in a cryostat. I should have mentioned they're sitting, the bath is sitting at liquid helium temperatures. There's going to be light emission. That's what we're looking at in all these experiments. Now we're going to send it through a Michelson interferometer. So we're going to send the light through two legs of a Michelson, and we're going to image them, the reflection from each mirror back onto the entrance of an imaging spectrometer. But we're going to misalign it slightly to make two images. And there's a reason why we're going to do that. Essentially, what we want to do is we're going to start with this double image, which is represented down here. So this is two images of the same spot, the condensate spot, with a left side and a right side. And as we change the misalignment, we can bring those two spots to overlap on top of each other. So now we're interfering the left side of the spot with the right side of the same spot. What this is going to do is essentially tell us the correlation of the coherence in the plane. It's going to tell us whether there's correlation between the left and right side of the emission. And so when we do that experiment, this is what we see. Below the critical threshold, we see essentially no fringing whatsoever. And this is with a path difference of about 8 millimeters between the two legs. And so this is a pretty long coherence time. When we go above the threshold, we see nice fringing. Okay, and we can then plot a visibility as a function of position and so on. So indeed, we see that there's a dramatic difference in the behavior of the light, that the light is now being emitted as coherent light coming out. And there's another thing that happens in this sample. Below the threshold, we can analyze for the polarization state of the light emitted. Now, I told you we were pumping it with circularly polarized light. If we look at the light emission below the threshold, which is again in the normal state, you always have to sort of recalibrate. Below means not condensed in our case because we're talking about lower densities. We see that the light is unpolarized, which makes sense because there's all kinds of scattering and so on, so that the polarization state of the photons has no relation to the polarization state of the light emitted by the polaritons. On the other hand, as we turn up the density, we see it becomes linearly polarized. Why would that happen? Well, essentially, if you imagine that there is a small splitting of the ground state, which could happen through a number of reasons. There's tiny terms in the Hamiltonian which lead to splitting of those states. But we imagine that's small compared to KT. Well, then, in general, in that situation, the splitting of the ground state won't matter at all, and we won't have any kind of polarization of the light emission. If we, however, have a condensate, the condensate all wants to be in the same state. That's the definition of a condensate, when you have a macroscopic occupation of the same state. Well, what state is it going to pick? Well, if there was no splitting at all, then it would have to pick spontaneously between one of the two states and jump in that state. But if there is a tiny splitting, as there is in these crystals, then it will jump into whatever the lower one is, and so that's what brings about this linear polarization. And so this linear polarization is aligned along the 110 crystal axis. And actually, it twists. If we turn up the stress, we can cause that to rotate a bit, because these mixing, the actual eigenstates depend on the local stress as well. This is an effect that actually was predicted by some theorists, and it's a basic effect of Bose condensates that they will choose one state to be in, whatever state that is, that's favorable. And so this is just a picture of, the threshold behavior, that the linear polarization jumps up right at that same threshold. And this is the same data sort of summarized. Okay, now, the last thing I want to talk about in terms of data is the angle-resolved luminescence. And this is an important part of the whole story. I want to go back to this picture I gave you of the microcavity polaritons. And I said that the polaritons can die by emitting photons that leave the system, because these are not perfect mirrors. These are partially reflecting mirrors. Well, Snell's law essentially is that the in-plane component of K has to be conserved in that process. And so that's a general rule for any optical emission process. So here we have the motion of the polaritons in the plane. That whole thing can die by emitting a photon. There's going to be a Z component and a K parallel component. The Z component is essentially just that KZ that was combined there. But this now has to be conserved, okay? What that means is then if we do an angle resolve measurement, we're directly measuring the K parallel component. Okay? So we're going to do this by swinging an arm. We literally have a little fiber optic on the end of an arm, and we're going to swing it around, and we're going to measure the angular distribution of the photons. That directly gives us the momentum distribution of the particles. And that's a really nice thing. A lot of times, in order to get the momentum distribution of a system, you have to do some kind of scattering thing. You have to do neutron scattering or something. Here, it's data. The angular distribution of the photons is the momentum distribution of the particles. And so what we want to look for then is evidence of K-space narrowing, which is the canonical effect for condensation. Okay, so this is, again, increasing the power as we go through this transition. Here, again, below the transition at low density, we have basically a thermal distribution. So this is just the way to think about this is energy versus K. This is the dispersion of the polaritons, the effective mass. So just fitting this to a parabola gives us the effective mass. As we turn up the power, we see that indeed it starts to narrow. And as we keep turning it up, we again, boom, see highly narrow focused emission just from the K equals zero state. Right, so this is evidence of the condensation, okay, that we're getting everything narrowing in K space and being emitted just at that point. And also notice how the spectral width changes. Here we have a broad distribution. Here it becomes essentially instrumental it's resolution limited. That's one pixel of our resolution. This is just showing the same data another way. So this is now an intensity plot. So that's the same thing. That's that parabolic curve. All right. At low density, this is, again, our excited states, our thermal distribution. As we turn up the power through this threshold, we see this K equals zero part just jump up and everything else stay essentially the same. And so this is what atomic people sometimes call a bimodal distribution. That instead of having one broad thermal distribution that just gets bigger, we see a peak sitting, a K equals zero sitting on top. And this is, again, plotting the data, the same data in yet another way, which is now to extract the energy of each state and plot that. The reason why that's important is because Maxwell-Boltzmann is a straight line. So Maxwell-Boltzmann is what you would expect for classical statistics. You would expect to have a Maxwell-Boltzmann occupation number, e to the negative e over kt. What we see is at low density, it's not thermalized. It's not even a well-defined temperature. As we turn up the power, we get, first of all, a Maxwell-Boltzmann-type distribution. And then as we turn up further, we see this peaking up. And again, this is this large peak sitting at the K equals zero state. So that's sort of the canonical prediction for condensation, that you should have a large occupation of the K equals zero state. Now, here's where some of the quibbles come in. This is the canonical this is what you predict for an ideal Bose gas, simply that the occupation number, that's what we're plotting here, because again, that's direct data for us. This is not deduced from something else. This is data for us. For Maxwell-Boltzmann, that should be a straight line. For Bose-Einstein, it should be a straight line on a semi-log plot, but then have this peaking up here. Can we fit our momentum distribution data to this distribution? And the answer is not quite. Okay? If I say, let me get the temperature by fitting the high energy tail, that would give me a temperature for this particular data set of about 80 Kelvin. So this is already, you know, pretty high compared to the lattice temperature. Remember I told you that the polaritons pick a temperature based on this steady state balance of pumping and cooling. But, okay, now if I say, what do I do if I get a Bose-Einstein fit at 80 Kelvin? What you see is, well, it fits okay for down here, but it completely misses this high energy tail. So something funny is going on. Well, what's going on is essentially that we don't have a really good equilibrium because the lifetime is only, as I said, about a factor of 2 or 3 longer than the scattering time. So these experiments are done in CW. So we're pumping high up in energy. We're letting these particles scatter down and fall down into the K equals zero state. Well, along the way, they have to give up energy, and so some of them will die before they ever get down to the bottom. What this means is in order to properly fit the data, we have to do a kinetic model. We can't just do an equilibrium model. So there's a basic physics question here. When we do standard thermodynamics, we always assume an equilibrium. The main reason we do that is because it's easier. That's the problems we know how to solve, right? Now the question is, if I'm not truly in equilibrium, how many of my thermodynamic predictions still stand up? What things will break down as I go far from equilibrium? This is an old story, and this is models that I've been doing. Alan remembers I've been doing this since the late 80s. You can essentially do what's called a quantum Boltzmann equation or a Fokker-Planck equation. This is an example of old data where we created excitons in some non-equilibrium distribution, and then we watched them as they evolved toward an equilibrium distribution. This is now a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. And we could fit with a scattering model, essentially using Fermi's golden rule to track where all the particles would go, conserving energy and momentum, and the relative scattering rates and so on. We can fit all this data to a model of their equilibration. So it's an interesting field in itself, because instead of saying, well, I'm either in non-equilibrium or I'm in equilibrium, I can say, for a given initial state, what is the path to equilibrium? Okay, and so that's a whole field on its own. Well, this is something that can be done for these polaritons as well. Let's see here. Okay. And so there's been several people working on this, including us, in the last few years. Again, essentially we're creating high up in energy. We're watching them scatter down through the exciton states until they fall into these polariton states, and this is where we're actually looking at them. And so we're going to do a computer model where we simply add up all the possibilities for all the different scattering channels and then say, and keep updating the distribution at each step in time according to the relative scattering rates. And one important thing that we have here is there are these final states factors. This is where the Bose statistics are going to come in this non-equilibrium picture. In non-equilibrium statistics, you have these 1 plus n final states factors. For each time you scatter from, say, K1 into K1 prime, you have a 1 plus n K1 prime. If these were fermions, those would be minus ions. That would be 1 minus n, which would be to say that you can't go into it at all if there's even one other particle. But if they're bosons, then however many particles are here, the more that are there, the more other ones want to jump in there. And that's the fundamental basis that causes all this the boson statistics to come in. All right, so we've been doing this model, and this is now this kinetic model with several different things that we can simply, in the numerics, we can turn on and off. This red curve is if we have only phonon scattering. So we allow the particles to scatter only scattering with phonons, and we see that we get essentially no particles whatsoever down in the ground state. Remember, this is where we want the condensate to appear to equal zero. So the phonons alone are not going to be able to give us that accumulation. Suppose I turn on the interactions. So this is the scattering between polaritons as they hit each other. But I don't include the stimulated emission parts. I don't include the 1 plus n factors. So I can do that, right? I can just turn it off in my computer program. All right, then I get the blue curve. Okay, so now you see, well, that's good. I do, in fact, get more occupation down in these low energy states. But I don't get this peaking. If I turn on the stimulated scattering terms, these 1 plus n final states terms, then I get something that looks like the data. So you notice here, though, that this is not a pure Bose-Einstein distribution. Okay, this is, there is this part here which is exciton-like, this part which is polariton-like, and this part here which is called the bottleneck region. In general, is there a piece of chalk here somewhere? This is a generic problem with all these systems. You have something that looks like this, where this is the exciton part, this is the polariton part. Okay, these guys scatter nicely between each other, and these guys scatter nicely between each other, but there's a huge mismatch between the mass of this and the mass of this. This is like 10 to the minus fourth of this mass. And so, in general, these particles accumulate in this region and have a hard time scattering down into this little dimple of the polariton states. And so that's what's called the polariton bottleneck. Well, what that means is that if we look at the distribution of the whole thing, we really have sort of two distributions on top of each other. One is this part here, which is the distribution of the polaritons, and then we have an excitonic type distribution, which is also sitting on top of it. It's really one continuous dispersion relation, but in some sense they act like two separate populations. Okay, so this is, I like this data series a lot here. This is analogous to a Feshbach resonance tuning in cold atom gases. What are we doing here? We're looking at, this is again our k-space distribution, which is just a momentum distribution, as we turn up the stress, which increases the coupling. So what is that doing? Well, essentially, in this case, when there's no stress or very little stress, in this case, this branch is entirely photon-like, or nearly all entirely photon-like, in which case, as I said, they don't interact with each other very well. There's almost no collisional terms. It's all just phonon emission. And in that case, you see that they never make it down to the k equals zero state. They're stuck up at this bottleneck region. As we turn up the stress, that's like turning on the interaction between the particles, because now we're mixing in the exciton part. Okay? So as we mix in the exciton part, now the collisions become important. So just like our simulation showed, this is all real data, by the way. This is not simulated data. This is real data. You have to say that these days, you know. It's just such nice clean data. Sometimes people say, well, is that real or is that simulated? No, this is real data, okay? So as we turn up the scattering, you see now they start to fill in, and as we turn it exactly get to resonance, now they're sitting exactly down, just as the data I showed you before, this broad thermal distribution. So this is just showing that our model predicts things correctly. If you notice here, a little bit hard to pick out, but this is about 6 millielectron volts between the bottom and where this bottleneck is, and that's exactly what our no polariton-polariton scattering tells us. That's just due to phonon scattering. They get stuck at that bottleneck. Okay. This now is just a set of, again, simulations that look like our data. Again, at low density, this is increasing density. At low density, it's non-thermal. As we increase the density, we start to get this turn-up. And that's fundamentally due to the Bose statistics. That, if you think about any Bose-Einstein distribution, you know, this occupation number, okay, which is the canonical Bose-Einstein occupation number, is just the steady-state solution for a system where the scattering terms have these 1 plus n final states factors. And so instead of talking about that only in equilibrium, we can talk about it in non-equilibrium by simply incorporating these 1 plus n factors. And that's what gives this buildup of this occupation, high occupation at the k equals 0 state. Okay, so this is a fit to a case. And now, what I've done here is I'm not looking at the part that I think is a condensate, because the condensate doesn't fit on that same distribution. The condensate is this additional delta function. What I've done is I've taken a case where it's in the normal state with slightly lower density than the condensate, and I fit that to our kinetic model, because our kinetic model doesn't include any coherence in it. It's just a Boltzmann Fermi-Golden rule type scattering. And indeed, we see we get a good fit to the data. And again, it's sort of two parts. There's the part for the polaritons, and then there's the high-energy part where it's becoming excitonic. So this is nice because we're saying now that we actually get decent fits to n of k, and that those fits only work if we have these 1 plus nk terms, which is due to the bosonic terms where these things are scattering with each other. Okay. Now, if I go back and now I just really press the system hard and I go to lower temperature and turn up my power, what you see is that in some cases I can push it so that now that ground state starts to spread out in k-space. Okay? So I think I mentioned that the ground state in real space is has got some intrinsic size. In K space, that's simply going to be the Fourier transform. Okay, so that's going to, if this is broad, that leads to something small here in K space, and reverse. If I have something narrow in real space, that leads to something broad in K space. So if you look at this, you see there's really, again, this bimodal thing. We have the thermal background, and sitting on top of it, this is this condensate state, which is now spread out in K space because this is a trapped system. It's not a delta in K, because the proper condensate state is one which is in the ground state of the system, which in this case is a Gaussian in real space, and therefore also a Gaussian in K space. Okay, now how much time do I have? About 5 minutes, roughly. Okay, let me skip this because this is a quibble that most of you won't be asking. yeah, I have to say, what's interesting now in sort of in pursuing this, I'll talk about this here. At this point now, you start to say, well, this looks like a condensate. Everything seems to be working out well. And so now it's sort of the job for the experts to say, well, okay, could we be deceived? Could there be other explanations for these things? And so this is a lot of what we've been doing to sort of say, what things might we have forgotten about? Let me just point out one thing here, which is to say, another evidence for the interactions of these particles is the fact that we see energy renormalization. So as we turn up the power here, I'm just sitting, this is again generating the particles here, I'm watching it flow down into the trap, which is here. And now I'm simply going to turn up the power, turn up the laser power, keeping it at the same place. And we see two things. One is we see that as we turn it up, we see a nice formation of the condensate down here. We see it very localized in this position. But the other is you notice the energy shift. Okay, so here this is, let me see, yeah, that's the bottom there. Okay, the energy is going to shift up by about a millielectron volt. Okay, and that's what in technical terms is called a mean field blue shift. It's due to the repulsive interactions between the particles that it renormalizes the energies. Okay, let me skip this. Alan, you can ask the KT question later if you want. Let me say this. This is a sequence comparing with the trap and without the trap. We can do this experiment without the trap. We just lift the stress off and return to flat band conditions. And what we see is qualitatively different behavior. In the flat potential case, when we hit this threshold, we see a very broad spectral distribution, whereas in the case of the trap, we see a much narrower distribution in energy. Okay, so they're saying there's really qualitative differences between the trapped and the non-trapped case, and I can come back to that if you're interested. Let me end with this. This is really a philosophical question that sometimes people raise. I just described a system in which I said, well, I'm pumping incoherently. I create excited carriers. They rattle around for a while, and out comes coherent light in a beam. Is this just a laser? I mean, isn't that what a laser is, right? You pump it, and you get coherent light out. So what's the difference between this and a laser? They might say some of this is just a terminology debate, but there's a fundamental difference between what we're doing in a standard laser. In a standard laser, the picture is the following. You start with some ground state. You pump electrons up to an excited state. They fall down into whatever the emitting state is. And then there's stimulated emission as these guys fall into that state. And the state which is highly occupied is the photon state. Okay? So we have these 1 plus n states factors, but those are for the photon states. All right? And so that's this branch that's being stimulated. Essentially what we're saying in these experiments with the polaritons is, we're pumping up to this excited state, but the stimulation is happening here. Okay, it's in moving from the higher states to the emitting state that the stimulation happens. So before any photons are emitted, it's the scattering of them with each other, this collisional scattering, that leads to the amplification. All right? So the amplification is happening in the electronic states here, and then afterwards we can have photons emitted or not. Another way of putting this is to say, in the standard laser, the coupling that leads to the amplification is due to radiative coupling. It's when the photon or the radiation field emitted by this oscillator goes over and excites this oscillator over here. And so in that picture, the oscillators could be as far apart as you like. They could be absolutely non-interacting. So I could have one oscillator here, one oscillator here, and put them very far apart from each other. And so there's no interaction other than the photon leaving the one and going over and hitting the other one. Okay, so that's the standard picture of a laser. It's an ensemble of two-level oscillators. In the case of the exotonic or polaritonic condensate, it's a very different picture. In this case, we're saying that what's driving the transition is the interaction of the oscillators with each other. Okay, that the oscillators are colliding and hitting each other, and actually the radiative coupling is irrelevant. Okay, so we can actually have negligible inversion. As a matter of fact, Peter Littlewood calls this lasing without inversion. That we don't have to have state filling or an inversion of the system in order to see the coherent light emission. It comes about because the oscillators themselves all scatter and become coherent, and now they can emit light very weakly, and they would still be coherent light. This has been demonstrated very dramatically by another group. I was actually collaborating with these guys a few years ago. This is the same sample, but two different thresholds. In one case, it's the polariton state that I just described, except this is not in a trap, so that changes some of the characteristics, but it's very similar. And what happens is you get that standard saturation curve that I showed you. We could do a separate experiment. We could actually use the same sample and make a laser, a regular laser. And the way we would do that is simply by going to another part of the sample. Again, this is without any trapping. Find a place where the photon branch is resonant with the free electrons and holes and not resonant with the exciton. All right? So that's just a standard laser in that case. And so that's just like having some continuum medium, and you've got a cavity, and you're amplifying one state. Well, in that case, you also see a threshold, but a couple things. One is it's two orders of magnitude higher in density than the polariton coherent emitter. So if nothing else, we have found a way to get coherent light emission with two orders of magnitude lower threshold. But there's also a qualitative difference between the E versus K, the dispersion of the medium. This is similar data to what I showed you as far as this angle resolved energy versus K. In a laser, you have a completely different effect, which is called mode pulling, which leads to a complete renormalization of the spectrum. And basically, without going into details, there are fundamental qualitative differences between these two things. And so you can tell the difference between a regular laser and this polaritonic state. So let me conclude with this then, several points. So first of all, I hope I've convinced you at the very minimum that cavity polaritons really are little particles that move around in the system, and they move from place to place. Next, we have many of the canonical evidences of Bose condensation. We have this bimodal momentum distribution, we have coherence, we have spontaneous symmetry breaking in the polarization. We have, at this point, consistency with our momentum distribution as measured and the steady-state kinetic models. And lastly, I don't want to quibble over terminology. People may want to call this what they will. You can call it coherent light emission without lasing, or you can call it lasing but in the strongly coupled regime, or you can call it lasing without inversion. Depends on what your definition of a laser is. But this is really something fundamentally different from a standard laser. And so we can call it the polariton laser. We can call it the polaritonic condensate. But it is truly a state where the matter itself is coherent and not just the photons that are coming out. So with that, I'll end. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. Questions, comments? Joseph?
I wonder if because of the phase-based density, does transition occur at a phase-based density near UPB
criteria? You mean the occupation number? That's what that NFK is, right? And all of this data, the angle resolved data, where is that? Okay, so for instance, this is data. These fits give us then a prediction for what the occupation number is. Okay, so this is saying this is 8 photons per state, or 8 polaritons per state. Okay, that's what N of K is. Per polariton state, yeah, not per photon state.
So I guess there have been other recent results in weakly interacting conventional gases that show that this transition doesn't occur where you would expect it to, because it has to do with the fact that it's two-dimensional. So it's striking to me that you did find it where you expected it to.
Are you talking about the Koestler's thallus thing, or? What's the other part of the story? Is it short?
Yeah,
Okay, well, I haven't showed a phase diagram here because this involves mapping out a lot of different temperatures and so on. But in general, you know, some people could raise the objection, well, in a two-dimensional system, you will never have a true delta function in k-space or delta function in energy for the particles. There will always be some width to that due to the fact that you're in two dimensions and there's fluctuations, okay? That doesn't stop you from seeing coherence, though, okay? It just means that your coherence length will not be infinite. But we already know it's not going to be infinite because we're in a trap, okay? And it's only going to be as large as the trap, okay? So what we show in those coherence measurements is that the coherence length is on the order of the size of the system, about 20 microns, okay? So we don't need it to be infinite. And in fact, it can't be infinite in a two-dimensional system for, I think, the reasons that you're raising. Now, it may be there are effects that say that the critical density, as we talk about, would be different from what you might expect from an ideal model, and I would not be at all surprised by that. The interactions will certainly shift things around.
I think what Joseph was asking was first initially the phase-space density. That's what you did. The requirement that the spacing between, you know, with the spacing between the particles is equal to the Rorty wavelength.
Right.
That gives the usual TC.
Right.
I'm saying, apparently, in some of the systems, the TC
right.
is much different.
Well, that's why I put a squiggle instead of an equal sign there, okay? Because the general condition is that the interparticle spacing should be comparable to the Rayleigh wavelength. But what that exact factor is system dependent, okay? And that may be a 2 pi or something in there. Yeah.
So I have a question about that beautiful key space mapping that they showed. So I want
this or?
Yes.
Uh-huh. The energy and the intensity is a function of angle. Yeah.
So how do you determine the 3 plus 0 position there? And then the second question is actually, what do you see actually for the first way? I mean, you showed plus minus 25 degrees.
Right. Okay. All right, so let me answer those separately. K equals 0 is just normal to the surface. Okay, so of the sample, right? So it's a two-dimensional plane, and the light that's coming out exactly perpendicular, which you can get by just lining it up with a helium neon laser or something and just, you know, getting the normal. So most of the state, I mean, 30 degrees is already pretty far out. It's pretty hard to collect it. But, I mean, yeah, you can see here it's bending over, and it becomes this. It looks like this if you were to keep mapping it all the way out. Now, you can't keep going on forever because you can't go past 90 degrees, right? So some of this is outside the light cone and can't be emitted at all right? But, yeah, you certainly will see exciton population up here as well. But in general, we don't take that data because we're really concerned about the polariton states. Well, by comparison to a model, you can, yeah. Yeah, so that's, right. So, I mean, that's, you know, this type of stuff, right? So you see occupation number per state, and then you can integrate that to get total density. Yeah.
What is the sort of typical the particle spacing relative to the size of the
thing? Okay, well, the typical densities are on the order of 10 to the ninth per centimeter squared. Okay, and I have to think about what that is in terms of an RS. Okay, but it works out to be comparable to the temperature. And the interaction length is basically on the order of the Bohr radius of the exciton. Okay, and the exciton, actually, you have to take a fraction of that because this is only partly excitonic. Okay, so if you just imagine taking the exciton part and only that part interacting, okay, so you're saying, you know, if each one is half of an exciton, then you have 1/4 the total scattering cross-section for the whole beast. Okay, but it's on the order of the exciton Bohr radius.
Just one last question. Christian?
Yes. When you were talking about bottleneck of like getting the condensation,
yeah.
Why don't we use parametric polariton scattering at the intersection point of the lower branch to get the signal in the condensate and the ions going to the exciton branch?
Okay, so he's referring to a set of experiments which was done by a number of groups, which is a very nice set of experiments. Okay, so you have, this is your dispersion relation. And there was a whole set of experiments in this polariton field called magic angle experiments. Okay, and what you do is if you pump here. So in our experiments, we pumped way up in energy. We watched them scatter down. Okay, you could say, well, let me pump here, and then there's a scattering process by which, by to conserve energy and momentum, one of them will scatter down to the ground state, and another will scatter up there. That's sort of what you're talking about, right? And so those experiments were done, and indeed, they see a huge population jumping up in the ground state there. The problem is the objection was raised, well, you're pumping with a coherent laser, and elastic scattering doesn't lead to any dephasing, and so the coherence here of your laser is directly mapped into the coherence of the ground state. So it's not a spontaneous coherence. All right? So these are nice experiments, and those were done. They show the bosonic nature of the particles, but they don't show any thermodynamics, because you're simply pumping directly into the ground state, this coherent state. So what we set out to do was to start with something completely incoherent and watch it form a condensate as we turn up the density. But other than that, these are nice experiments also that have been done. And, of course, a third one is I could have the laser come in exactly normal and just pump the state directly, right? And, of course, then people would obviously say, well, of course it's going to be coherent because you've shown a coherent laser on it. There was a proposal, which is if you use an intense incoherent source exactly normal to the surface, then you should be able to see coherence appear in that way. So just take a really bright light bulb and shine it normal to the surface, and you should see spontaneous coherence coming up that way. But technically, it's pretty hard to get an incoherent source that bright, although these are not really super bright.
Okay, David, as you've seen, you've stimulated an awful lot of interest in the water. Thank you very much for your
Okay, thanks.